From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Mozambique's twin disasters, floods and debt. We'll look at Western countries' sluggish response to the floods and how the IMF is strangling the African country. Also, why did corporations such as Chevron, Unocal, and Transamerica contribute thousands of dollars to Prop 21, a California ballot initiative that would put more youths in adult prisons? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 35 years after white lawmen clubbed civil rights marchers senseless in Selma, Alabama, an integrated detachment of Alabama State Troopers and National Guardsmen saluted people commemorating the anniversary of Bloody Sunday. President Clinton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson led Sunday's commemorative event. Clinton told an audience estimated at 10,000 that as a white Southerner, the March for Voting Rights set him free also, and that he had to be there. On Sunday, March 7, 1965, white state troopers and sheriff's deputies used tear gas, nightsticks, and whips to break up an attempt by hundreds of blacks and white supporters to cross the bridge and march 50 miles to the state capitol in Montgomery to protest the denial of voting rights to blacks. 2 weeks later, under the protection of a federal court, Martin Luther King Jr. led hundreds of people on the walk to Montgomery. Within months, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Meanwhile, a group that wants the South to secede from the United States a second time held a Confederate flag-waving rally in Montgomery, Alabama, this weekend. An estimated 2,500 people showed up. Confederate flags and rebel yells rose from the steps of Alabama's Capitol at the Old South Rally. Bagpipers played Dixie, joined Civil War reenactors to lead a parade to the building where Jefferson Davis took the oath as president of the Confederacy in 1861. Afterward, members of the Southern Nationalist Organization that staged the rally signed a Declaration of Southern Cultural Independence. They described it as the first step in what they hope is a second secession by the South. This news from Louisville, Kentucky. The mayor has fired the city's police chief after two white officers who shot an unarmed black teenager to death were given departmental awards for valor in the confrontation. The chief's dismissal last Thursday night brought demands from the police union for the resignation of the mayor, Dave Armstrong. Nine district police commanders stepped down from their posts in protests, and hundreds of officers and their supporters marched on City Hall to protest the mayor's action. Mayor Armstrong fired the police chief, Gene Sherrard, a day after the awards ceremony. The mayor called the decision to honor them premature and insensitive. A grand jury cleared the officers of criminal wrongdoing, but a follow-up investigation by the city's public safety director outlined numerous errors by the officers. Bob Jones University's decision to lift its half-century-old ban on interracial dating has stunned students and the fundamentalist Christian school's supporters, who learned about it Friday night in a national television interview with President Bob Jones III. Jones said the extraordinary national scrutiny the school has received since George W. Bush made a campaign appearance led to the move. Bush appeared at the school last month and, under intense pressure, apologized for failing to criticize the school's anti-Catholic views and racial policies. The school had defended the dating ban based on a biblical interpretation that God created people differently for a reason. This news from Washington, D.C. Amtrak has settled a racial discrimination suit for the second time in 9 months, the latest one alleging that white supervisors had created a hostile work environment for black engineering employees in the Northeast. Amtrak admitted no wrongdoing in the settlement announced Friday, but the National Railway did agree to change personnel policies. The settlement, which must be approved by a federal judge, sets up a $16 million fund to provide economic relief to 800 to 1,000 black employees who suffered discrimination since 1995, and as many as 4,000 black job applicants who were turned away by Amtrak. The suit claimed that Amtrak had discriminated in hiring, disciplining, training, and promoting blacks. This news from London. 2 weeks after he narrowly missed being chosen as the governing Labour Party's candidate in the race for mayor of London, progressive lawmaker Ken Livingstone said today he will run as an independent. His decision prepares the way for a tough battle between the popular, blunt-spoken Livingstone and the Labour candidate, former Health Secretary Frank Dobson, who has the backing of Prime Minister Tony Blair. Livingstone got the nickname Red Ken when he led the Greater London Council in the 1980s, gaining national prominence for slashing subway fares and entertaining the outlawed Irish Republican Army. And finally, the Boeing company said striking engineers and technical workers will get a raise today if they decide to return to their jobs. The union for 17,000 striking workers dismissed the action as an attempt to get workers to cross picket lines and called it an unfair labor practice. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Weather forecasters predicted renewed rain in the worst-hit areas of flooded Mozambique today as a multinational relief operation battles to deliver aid to communities marooned by seas of mud. The prospect of more rain has been a major concern for aid workers as they race to ship essential supplies to communities weakened by hunger and disease. Helicopters have pulled more than 13,000 people from roofs and treetops just in the last week. The death toll is expected to soar into the thousands as water levels subside to reveal the drowned and cases of malaria and cholera increase. Aid workers warn that many people may starve to death. The West has been severely criticized for its sluggish response to the disaster, with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan saying last week that the response could have been better. Joseph Hanlon joins us now. He's just returned from Mozambique, and we found him in London, England. In the last few years, he has written several books on Mozambique. His latest is called Peace Without Profit, How the IMF Blocks Rebuilding in Mozambique. And in an article he did for the Multinational Monitor, giving us a little background, he wrote, "Until 1992, Mozambique was a Cold War battlefield. A particularly brutal decade-long war killed 1 million of Mozambique's 15 million people and inflicted $20 billion in damages. RENAMO rebels, with the open backing of apartheid South Africa and right-wing U.S. business people, and with covert U.S. government approval, destroyed 60% of the nation's primary schools, half of all health posts, and half of all rural shops. One of every three families was forced to flee their homes at least once during the decade-long war. The cause of the ongoing suffering is IMF-imposed stabilization policies as conditions for ending the civil war. The United States forced Mozambique to join the IMF and World Bank in 1984 and then to impose a modified form of World Bank-mandated structural adjustment in 87. That was not enough, however, and in 1990, Mozambique had to accept the much harsher IMF-controlled stabilization. By then, Mozambique had also become the most aid-dependent country in the world. We are now joined by Joseph Hanlon. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Well, you've just come from Mozambique. Can you describe the picture there today?
Well, the water is beginning to go down slowly, and as the water goes down, it will reveal the amount of destruction that has taken place. Many miles of roads and railways have been destroyed or washed out. factories have been destroyed, fields have been destroyed. For the southern third of the country, this is going to be devastating for the economy, and it will take, I think, some time for this to be restored, for some time for people to actually even to get back to their homes. Even now, people don't know if anything is left of their own homes, and several hundred thousand people at least are surely homeless. One of the things that in a way is most frightening is that these are many of the same people who were refugees during the war. And when the war ended 7 years ago, they came back, they did their best to rebuild, and virtually all of that rebuilding work since the war has now been washed away, and they're going to have to start again. And these are some of the poorest people in the world. Probably most of these refugees are living on less than a dollar a day and are subsistence farmers who have slowly, slowly rebuilt their lives. Now they have to start again.
Joseph Hanlon, author of the book Peace Without Profit, How the IMF Blocks Rebuilding in Mozambique. That war, which devastated the country by 84, coming out of 1980 U.S. election of Ronald Reagan, which intensified the Cold War in South Africa, launching attacks on Mozambique in 1981. We're also joined on the telephone by Mike Delaney, who's Director of Humanitarian Assistance for Oxfam International. He joins us from their headquarters in Boston. Mike Delaney, I've been seeing these ads you've been placing in the major newspapers for help for Mozambique. What has been the response, both of individuals but also of governments?
Yeah, yesterday we ran the first ad in the New York Times Sunday edition, and basically titled Send a Lifeline to Mozambique. And so far, the American people have really responded quite impressively. And we're again receiving a lot of calls of concern and support this morning.
What about countries?
Well, so far, we're looking at the response coming in from different countries. Most of that is done bilaterally. And that has escalated as the gravity of the situation has become apparent.
Joseph Hanlon, we talk about these twin devastations that are rocking Mozambique, one being the natural disaster, the floods, the cyclones, the rains, but the other being a more structural one, which has to do with how the West deals with Mozambique. Can you talk about that?
Mozambique is really facing two structural crises. One is its debt, which is left over really from the apartheid era, and the second is conditionality, which is imposed by the IMF, which makes it very difficult to reconstruct. Let's start first with the debt problem. Mozambique is deeply in debt because of the apartheid onslaught. It borrowed money to defend its people against the apartheid state. Since the end of apartheid, Nelson Mandela has become president, he's retired, he's gone away, and yet the Mozambican people are still paying the costs of apartheid. Mozambique has had part of its debt canceled. The IMF and the World Bank are now saying in April it will have a bit more of its debt canceled. But even after the next debt cancellation, Mozambique will pay $1 million a week in debt service. This is paying off the debts that were taken to defend against apartheid. Now, it is crazy for Mozambique to be appealing for money to rebuild and to be paying $1 million a week in debt service payments. It makes no sense. And in fact, one of the Nordic countries is actually, instead of giving money to aid Mozambique, is actually giving money to Mozambique to help repay its debts. So the first thing that Mozambique needs is debt cancellation. Britain has actually agreed now to cancel Mozambique's debts. We think Italy is about to cancel Mozambique's debts. But other countries have to do this as well. It just doesn't make sense.
What about the U.S.?
The U.S. so far hasn't promised to cancel Mozambique's debt. And in a way, the problem is not national governments, because the debts to national governments is smaller than the debts to the World Bank and to the IMF. And the World Bank and the IMF are offering nothing so far. What we saw with Hurricane Mitch in Latin America was that the World Bank and the IMF continued to collect money from those countries, even as debt relief was, as flood relief was flowing in, they were still repaying their money. Now, what we need for Mozambique is that this debt should simply be written off. We should say this is a Cold War debt. We should write it off. We should give Mozambique a chance to start again. But what we're saying is we'll write off a little bit of the debt, and then we'll lend you some more money. Because the other thing the IMF has said is, yes, we will rush in extra money to help you rebuild the roads, but that's not a grant. This is loans. This, the World Bank, with one voice, is saying, we know you can't repay your debts. With the other voice, is saying, well, our solution is to lend you more money to get you deeper and deeper in debt. And all those new loans come with conditions. And the conditions are that Mozambique cannot control the development of its own economy, that the free market must rule. Now, what the free market ruling in Mozambique means is that all development is concentrated in the capital, which was not affected by these floods at all. The zones that are affected by the floods, the private sector is not interested in. There is no bank credit in those areas. How are the small business people of those areas going to restore shops, restore other businesses? Who is going to develop those areas? And yet the IMF says, well, if the free market is not interested in developing those areas, then those areas simply shouldn't be developed. So what you're getting is an incredibly distorted development in Mozambique, where one-third of the country's entire GDP is in the capital, two-thirds of proposed investment is in the capital, and the government is not allowed to try to redistribute that development to poorer areas.
I want to compare what the U.S. and other countries, how they're responding right now to this crisis in Mozambique, to how the countries were responding to Kosovo. Mike Delaney of Oxfam International.
Well, it's a very interesting comparison, because one of the things that we were looking at in these past weeks is seeing a gravity of the situation and not seeing the same response that we have seen in other places, including Mitch or Kosovo or Timor. And that was part of the reason that we felt it important to get the word out this weekend and explain the story a bit in that ad. We feel that, especially as it relates to, I think, getting back to this point on the debt, there's a real opportunity here to for people in the United States to take this and tragedy and move it into an opportunity by urging their Congress people who are coincidentally looking at this debt issue this week in Congress, a debt relief that would unlock $250 million for Mozambique over the next 20 years. And if the people of the United States urge their Congress people to do this, we could both have emergency response as well as having a response that would affect the long-term sustainability of the country.
In terms of responses, I wanted to bring in a third guest, Joki Jehu, who is the head of the 50 Years is Enough campaign, who's mobilizing for some major actions against the IMF and World Bank in Washington in April. Joki Jehu, your response to the crisis in Mozambique right now.
The crisis in Mozambique, of course, is heartbreaking, and I think that my colleagues have really spoken to some of the issues that are underlying. We saw a similar crisis in Honduras and Nicaragua after Hurricane Mitch, and it was very clear, this is less than 2 years ago, it is very clear that one of the first actions that the international community can do after doing massive humanitarian response is debt cancellation, and it's looking at how a country like Mozambique, or in the case of Mitch, Nicaragua and Honduras, pick up and move on after the crisis has ended.
Joki Jehu, I'm going to break in for a second. We have to allow stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, we'll ask what you're doing in Washington, D.C. in these next few weeks. Joki Jehu with 50 Years is Enough Network. Also on the line with us, Mike Delaney, Oxfam International. And Joseph Hanlon, member of Jubilee 2000 in Britain, has just returned from Mozambique and is author of the book Peace Without Profit, How the IMF Blocks Rebuilding in Mozambique. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After that discussion, we will go to California to look at what could be one of the most draconian laws in the country passed tomorrow, Prop 21, and we'll look at what it means for young people in California. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the issue of Mozambique and the terrible crisis it's facing, the water levels extremely high, death toll expected to soar into the thousands, cases of malaria and cholera increasing. Our guests are Joseph Hanlon of Jubilee 2000 in Britain, Mike Delaney of Oxfam International, and Jokey Jehu of the 50 Years is Enough Network in Washington, D.C. Jokey Jehu, your plans?
We plan to make sure that when the World Bank and the IMF meet in Washington, that people from around the United States and people from around the world are here to bear witness, if you will, and to talk about their concerns, their very grave concerns about the policies and practices of these institutions. We are planning massive, mass nonviolent direct action. We are planning teach-ins on the issues, structural adjustment programs, debt, environmental destruction of this of the World Bank. We are also planning teach-ins on nonviolence training, civil disobedience, media, and legal work.
Now, the event begins on April 9th with a major rally for cancellation of the debt.
Yes. Jubilee 2000 USA has called for a national mobilization on April 9th on the Mall in Washington. And that marks the beginning of a week of events that will be happening that are related and unrelated to focus attention on the spring meetings of the World Bank and the IMF.
And then when are the civil disobediences going to take
place? The main mass action is on April 16th and 17th, but the week includes the Economic Way of the Cross by the Religious Working Group, includes a Latin America Solidarity Conference, includes an IFG International Forum on Globalization teaching, and includes teachings by the Mobilization for Global Justice, which is a coalition that has come together to plan for April here in Washington, D.C.
I understand these planning meetings are getting more and more packed. Do you think we're going to see something on the scale of Seattle?
Well, we will see definitely a lot more people. There's no way of telling. We do know that there are people around the country who are planning. And if your listeners go to www.a16.org, they can see examples of where people are coming from, caravans and roadshows from Florida all the way to Montreal, buses from Plattsburgh, New York, and from Rochester, New York, from Asheville, and people riding the Greyhound from Austin, Texas. There's a lot of planning and a lot of commitment from people around the world and around the United States in particular, which is significant because these institutions don't make policies in the U.S. Their policies are implemented by the U.S. government, but they do not impose policies the way that they do in the Global South through structural adjustment programs and other austerity measures.
Well, Jokey Jehu, I want to thank you for being with us. Again, that website, www.a16.org. Mike Delaney of Oxfam, what is your website or contact number?
It's www.oxfamamerica.org.
And phone number for people who want to call who are concerned about the situation in Mozambique?
1-800-77-OXFA, 1-800-77-OXFAM.
Joseph Hanlon, final comment from Britain, having just returned from Mozambique.
the thing that Mozambique needs most now is money, and money will come from debt cancellation, and money will come from additional help from the international community. But I would call on people in the United States to go farther than is even being proposed in Congress, because Congress does not want to cancel all of Mozambique's debt yet. We have to cancel all of the debt and give Mozambique a chance to really start again.
Joseph Hanlon, author of Peace Without Profit, How the IMF Blocks Rebuilding in Mozambique. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Next up, we're going to talk about what's happening in California tomorrow, a proposition that has been put forward called Prop 21 and what it will mean for young people.
Oh, Africa, nobody ever apologized for when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the whites. They took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa. I'm sorry for my people. I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, nobody ever said it was wrong. Though you cried long and loud in your pain when your life was gone. But no one cared, they took you as slaves and changed your life and your culture too. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people. I'm sorry what they did to you. Oh, sorry, Africa. Oh, sorry, Africa. Oh, sorry, Africa. Oh, sorry, Africa.
Tony Bird singing oh, sorry, Africa, here on Democracy Now! Well, thousands of kids may be tried, sentenced, and imprisoned as adults after California's primary elections tomorrow under a proposition ballot initiative that is being opposed by judges, defense lawyers, probation officers, and prisoners' advocates. It's known as Proposition 21, or the Gang Violence and Juvenile Crime Prevention Act, and it comes to voters courtesy of major corporations like Chevron, Pacific Gas and Electric, and Unocal. If Prop 21 is approved by voters, it would make California the strictest, most conservative state in the nation on juvenile crime and punishment. Among other things, it would require children as young as 14 to be tried in adult courts for serious offenses, give prosecutors expanded powers to try juvenile offenders as adults for a range of less serious crimes, and sentence anyone 16 or older convicted in adult court to adult prisons. The corporations put tens of thousands of dollars into the ballot effort as a political favor to former Governor Pete Wilson, a major proponent of Prop 21. We're going to start off this half of the program with Vince Beiser. He is senior editor at Mother Jones and author of the piece Money Plus Politics Equals Jailed Kids. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Vince.
It's good to be here.
Can you explain who is behind this initiative?
Yeah, the initiative was set up by Pete Wilson, Governor Pete Wilson, and it's basically sort of a grab bag of different tough on juvenile crime initiatives that he was not able to pass into law while he was governor. So he basically sort of rolled a bunch of them all into this under this one umbrella right around the time that he was starting his run for the Republican nomination to be president.
Explain the companies, though, why they are invested in this.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing about this initiative. Almost all of the money behind it came from a whole range of different companies. And basically, it seems to be nothing but political favor swapping, because it's all about juvenile justice, this initiative. It's got nothing to do with any of the direct interest of any of these corporations. It's a bunch of oil companies, utility companies. There's a Nevada casino company that gave a bunch of money. And it seems very clear, and in fact, most of them admitted to me when I called them up that really it was just a matter of doing a favor for their old friend Pete Wilson, and sort of trying to get in good with him while he was making his run for the presidency. Just as simple as that. They have no interest in this kind of legislation, they have no real stake in the outcome. But, when a politically powerful ally comes knocking on your door, sure, toss them $50,000.
We had trouble getting the corporations to be on the show today, but Pacific Gas and Electric spokesperson Ron Lowe, though he said he couldn't make it on the program, was willing to record a statement about the utility company's involvement with
Prop 21. The company's position is and always has been neutral on Proposition 21.
Now, I understand that your company donated money to the proposition.
The company contributed $50,000 in the spring of 1998 to help qualify this initiative for the ballot, allowing the people of California the opportunity to hear a debate on both sides of the issues, pro and con, and make their decision when they go to the ballot box. The purpose of the contribution was to allow the people of California to become informed on this important issue and allow them, when they go to vote next Tuesday, to vote based on the information they've received.
So basically, the organization is not taking a stand on the proposition, but rather gave money in order to have the ballot initiative available for voters to decide on.
Correct. The company's position is and always has been neutral on Proposition 21. Our contribution went to help qualify this important public policy debate for the ballot, allowing the voters of California the opportunity to hear a debate, a healthy debate on both sides of the issues, and when they go to the ballot box, make an informed decision.
So that was Ron Lowe, interviewed by Democracy Now! Producer David Love, saying that the utility is not taking a stand on Prop 21, but wants to give people an opportunity to vote on it. Your response, Vince Beiser of Mother Jones.
I mean, I think that's completely laughable. By the way, Amy, I should just say I'm actually senior editor with Mother Jones' online sister publication, The Mojo Wire, at motherjones.com, as opposed to the printed magazine.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I think that, I mean, the idea that you give $50,000 to a ballot initiative that you're neutral on it, I mean, I think it's just ludicrous on the face of it. It's not as though PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is putting up money to, sponsor public debates on this issue or, to print literature informing people about it. They just gave $50,000 to the people who are pushing the initiative, and to call that neutral is absurd on its face, I think.
John Lum also joins us. He's chief probation officer of San Luis Obispo in California, opposes Prop 21. Why do you oppose it as a probation officer?
Well, I think some of the obvious considerations is I'm not quite certain what it's attempting to solve. The premise behind the proposition is that we have a very serious juvenile crime problem in California, and I imagine, given the increased amount of incarceration required by the proposition, there's also a belief that the most effective way to make people safer in their communities is to rely heavier on incarceration. The reality is that statistics show clearly that juvenile crime in California, if not across the entire country, has significantly decreased, though the population of juveniles in California and other jurisdictions throughout the country, of course, has increased. Further, I've been involved in working in corrections for well over 20 years, and I've never seen a report, and clearly not in California, that in any way suggests that incarceration alone, specifically punishment alone, is a great public safety protector.
We're also joined by Picolia Manigo, who is an 11th grader at Burton High School in San Francisco and a member of Critical Resistance Youth Force, which is a coalition of 31 youth organizations working on criminal justice issues and prisons. Picolia, how are you involved in Prop 21?
As of tomorrow will be my your first year anniversary of working on Proposition 21. Pretty much the involvement I've been taking in it and a lot of students around the Bay Area and around the state is informing our peers, our parents, our communities about it. through presentations, through actions, as in direct actions on corporations, and state offices like jails and county jails and prisons, and even Pete Wilson, to inform them that the students of California, the people who are affected by this, do not support this at all and feel that the government and Pete Wilson should have found a much better way to think of prevention than incarceration, especially one that's going to cost us a lot of money.
Proposition 21 has united high school students in opposition across California. You've had dozens of rallies and marches in recent days, but the proponents of the measure include the current California governor, Gray Davis, sheriff's organizations, victim rights groups, and virtually every district attorney in the state. They say that Proposition 21 is intended for the small percentage of violent, predatory criminals who happen to be youths. What's your response to that, Pecolia?
I don't feel that Proposition 21 targets specific people. It's a broad initiative. It has broad standing. As far as what my analysis is, of it is, and as far as what we as high school students see on a daily level, what Proposition 21 proposes is you're guilty before proven innocent, and that's not right. We have a broad range of things in Proposition 21, from gang member, crime, down to quote-unquote juvenile crime. And as far as what presentations I have been doing, people who have already been through the system, who've already have already been rehabilitated, have said, oh, if Proposition 21 passed, I wouldn't be here today. Who have already gotten rehabilitated and are back in school, getting 2.5s and 3.0s and 371s, who have changed their lives because they have been through the current system, saying that if Proposition 21 passed, they would not have gotten the chances that they did. So, as far as like what is supposed to do, prevention, doesn't ring a bell in my mind. It just rings a bell that says, okay, we're talking about mass incarceration of a lot of youth who in the current system will be rehabilitated, will be given a chance, but with Proposition 21, it won't give them that chance.
Hmm. John Lum, I wanted to get your response to Proposition 21 campaign manager Matt Ross, who says that the system was designed, the current system in the 40s, for things like truancy and curfew violations, that no one anticipated, he says, we'd have juvenile rapists and murderers. He says we still aren't equipped to handle them in the juvenile justice system.
Well, I'm not so certain where he gets his information about the 40s. Indeed, the juvenile court has been around for over 100 years, and to my knowledge, has dealt with serious juvenile offenders throughout its lifespan. When I was in New York State, for example, clearly we were working on those kinds of issues in North Carolina and other jurisdictions where I've had the opportunity to work. I think that it sounds good, like many things that relate to disenfranchised people in our society. And let's be very specific, in California, two-thirds of the young people that are in our juvenile justice system are minorities, many of whom have been abused themselves, many of whom have not had an opportunity to have the same connection to the economic prosperity and other things that are happening in California. Research has conclusively shown that the majority of young people who come into the juvenile justice system are people who have learning disabilities, who either because they didn't have the resiliency or the advocacy from a parent, or maybe a parent was absent, or maybe it was a single parent who's struggling to try to take care of usually her family, they end up getting withdrawn from our public schools or thrown out, quite frankly, in many cases, and end up on the streets and end up in the juvenile justice system. We work profoundly with young people and have turned many lives around. If you look at the number of kids coming into the system and then the number of adult offenses, there's not, research would not lead to the conclusion that he has reached. If we step back in our society and not be so reactionary to something, and actually to take a look at what the research and facts suggest to us, and really consider those facts in making a determination, there's no question about the fact that we would all reach the conclusion that Prop 21 is yet just another, doesn't it sound like, getting tough on crime. Doing time is not getting tough on crime. Most of us who work in the system recognize that the most difficult thing for a young person to do to turn their life around is to restore themselves, to restore themselves to the community, to earn their way back into the community's trust, to really make peace with a victim who they have offended, and then to restore themselves, to deal with those issues that are relevant in their lives that they need to work on to turn around, and then to re-enter our community as a productive citizen.
John Lum and Pacolia Manigo and Vin Spicer, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll go to another state across the country, Florida, which has instituted a similar law, and talk with a student and a lawyer about what it has meant for Florida. Pacolia Manigo is an 11th grader from Burton High School in San Francisco. John Lum, Chief Probation Officer of San Luis Obispo in California. And Vin Spicer, Senior Editor at Mother Jones Online, author of the piece Money Plus Politics Equals Jailed Kids. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Looking at the New York Times today, they do a whole feature on California Proposition 21, saying it would become the strictest, most conservative state in the nation, California, on juvenile crime and punishment. At issue, the ballot initiative sponsored by Pete Wilson, the former governor, who also sponsored the Three Strikes You're Out law that made the penalty for a third felony conviction, even for stealing a slice of pizza, a minimum of 25 years to life in prison. Under the current initiative, which according to the latest polls is likely to pass, teenagers arrested for even minor crimes would be stripped of many protections currently afforded in juvenile court, and if convicted, would face many of the same penalties as adult felons. I have in front of me the League of Women Voters recommendations for the various propositions in California on Super Tuesday tomorrow. And on Proposition 21, they say no, the Juvenile Crime Act, opposing the measure because it adds, they say, to the law numerous punitive measures for juvenile offenses that they believe are unnecessary, giving prosecutors rather than judges the authority to send teenagers to adult court, and the expense of the measure because of longer incarceration terms, higher court costs, and added bureaucratic requirements would add so much to both state and local costs that it could take away funding from new preventive programs. Programs, they say, which are both more humane and more cost-effective and are working to build safer communities. But we're going to go now to Florida, where Marie Osborne and Claudia Kemp are standing by. Marie Osborne is chief of the juvenile division of the Miami-Dade Public Defenders. Claudia Kemp, a law student at Florida State University in Tallahassee. Marie Osborne, tell us about Florida's laws and the similar rules in the criminal justice system that have been in place for a number of years.
Yes, Florida passed their expansive direct file law in 1994, and Florida used the same disingenuous rationale that California and Pete Wilson is trying to urge, which is that this law is intended for that small percentage of really violent children we just can't do anything about. as with California, Florida always had the right to try children as adults, and judges routinely waived those violent children whose records or whose current crime warranted waiver into the adult court. So you can always try a child as an adult. You can in California today. You don't need this law. But prosecutors and law enforcement, police urged this law because it was a fast train. It meant that judges didn't have to be involved. We didn't have to prove anything. We could do it really quickly. And the result is now that not only does Florida lead the nation in the number of children in the adult system, but in 1997, and I'm looking at the statistics given out by Governor Bush himself right in front of me, in 1997, less than 17% of the children who were sent down statewide, less than 17% of those children got 1 year or more. That means 83% got probation. They got time served. They got a slap on the wrist, and they're now on our streets, convicted felons, dead-end lives, no hope, nothing, idle men. This is hardly a recipe for safety. And what's happened is the floodgates opened. I mean, under our draconian sentencing, believe me, any kind of burglary or double burglary would warrant 10, 15, 20 years. If only 17% of the children are getting 1 year or more, that means the kids that are being sent downtown are not violent. By definition, they can't be. They'd be put away by our sentencing scheme. This is a way to get all kinds of kids downtown for all kinds of reasons: administrative convenience, expediency, backlog in the juvenile court, everything but targeting that 1% of violent crime. That's their nonsense rationale, but that's not what happened in Florida, and that's not what will happen in California.
Claudia Kemp, you're a law student at Florida State University in Tallahassee, and you've been working with the school's Children Advocacy Center, particularly working on the case of Jessica Robinson, who was sentenced as an adult when she was 13 years old and is doing a 9-year sentence at an adult facility in Miami. Sentenced at the age of 13?
Yes. Well, a sentence at the age of 14. The offense was committed at the age of 13.
Tell us her story.
Well, Jessica and co-defendants were broke into her, robbed her grandmother and grandfather, and were charged with armed burglary with assault and battery, robbery, and armed kidnapping. And they were indicted. And under Florida law, you can indict a child of any age for a capital offense or a life felony. And they entered a plea of guilty and were sentenced. There was no real discussion about any alternate sentencing for these children, and I call them children because they are. They were 13, 14, and 15. She's been in a maximum security prison since her sentencing. She has no real family support. She has no visitors except for the visits from the students at the law center.
Wait, was she armed?
No, she was not armed.
And where does the kidnapping charge come from?
Her male co-defendant became armed once they were inside with a knife. He didn't. There was no, nobody required hospitalization. He lost control. The kidnapping is moving the grandparents from their dining room into their Florida room, their own house, in the interior of their own house. They weren't bound. They weren't in any way restrained, except by a threat from the young man. And then he left. And that's what the kidnapping charge is about, mm-hmm. which is what really gets them the greatest points for under the sentencing guidelines.
And where is Jessica today?
She is in Dade Correctional down in south of Miami. It's a very large maximum security prison.
Does she go to school in the prison?
No. In the adult system, it's not required. It's not mandatory. There's not educational programs in place that they must attend. She's now 16. She only has a sixth grade education. She failed the seventh grade. And she's adapting in order to survive.
How is she adapting?
Well, you know, particularly in female prisons, there's a real structured social hierarchy, a lot of family units. And a young inmate has to find her place. She has her role models are now people, women who have committed anything from car theft to premeditated first-degree murder.
You visited her every week.
Once I got the case back on May of 99, and we were looking at a post-conviction motion, I started visiting her and visited her until she moved to Dade, which is in October of 99, every week.
How do you think Jessica should have been dealt with?
I think that, as with every juvenile, they should have investigated the family dynamics. She's 13 years old. She's acting out. All of her crimes were against her family, not random victims on the street. I think she should have received probably placement in a secure juvenile detention center with what we call a mental health overlay, with additional counseling in to what the juvenile center would normally give, continue education. I mean, she's going to come out of there with nothing. I don't even know if she knows what she's going to come to. She has no family in the States, and her grandparents were the state witness. Hmm. I think a lot could have been done for her and her family.
Just a side issue, and that is, do people like Jessica who end up in prison, in adult prisons, are they able to vote later in life, or do they lose their right?
You know, I am not really sure how that works. I know that they do while they're incarcerated, but I'm not really sure how it works once they're released.
Marie Osborne, do you know, Chief of the Juvenile Division of the Miami-Dade Public Defenders?
You can petition to get your right to vote back, but if you're an ex-felon, no, you're not going to get it. I think in Jessica's case, as a convicted felon, that's not going to happen. And I should add, you know, Florida is number one in the nation, tied with Alabama, for disenfranchised black men. We don't have the statistics on Latins because we don't bother to keep them. But a third of our African-American men can't vote in this state. And that's a ripple effect that Californians need to think about, because the vast majority of judicially waived children in L.A. County in 1996, 95% were minority. You can imagine when it's going to be prosecutors being able to send everyone downtown that is 14 or older, that it's going to be at least 95% minority and maybe higher. And those people, you know, face a situation in which they're not only going to be idle and dead-end and convicted felons without job or education opportunities, but they're going to be disenfranchised. And whatever stake they have in the social contract is over. And I don't know how that's going to play out. You know, this is an experiment, and no one knows how it's going to play out when all these kids return in their 20s as idle men with no place to go and nothing to do. I don't see how this is going to advance public safety. That sounds very scary to all of us.
Claudia Kemp, you're a law student at Florida State University in Tallahassee, which is going to be the site this week of a major march on the state capitol. Thousands of civil rights protesters, organizers are estimating about 20,000, are going to be denouncing Florida Governor Jeb Bush's plan to end affirmative action protection, a real who's who of the American civil rights leaders, NAACP President Kwesi Mfume, Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Jesse Jackson will be there. Also, Patricia Ireland, National Organization for Women, a group called Coalition of Conscience. And I'm wondering if you see the issue of the end of affirmative action in any way connected to these draconian criminal justice laws, juvenile justice laws.
Well, I think that the connection is that it's a one more slap in the face for those who are disenfranchised. It's a failure to recognize that we don't have even playing fields, that if you want to talk about justice, you have to bring everybody up, hopefully, to some sort of even playing field before you start using these types of measures. That's how I would look at it.
Let's ask Pacolia Manigo, who is an 11th grader at Burton High School in San Francisco. Actually, here in New York, hundreds of high schoolers from around the city left school on Friday, and they marched over the Brooklyn Bridge. They were specifically dealing with the Giallo verdict, but overall talking about these issues of criminal justice enforcement. What about your thoughts on this law, Proposition 21, and the issue of prisons that you work on in California?
Around California, a lot of high school students, not just high school, but I've acknowledged that there were middle school students and a lot of college support, too, who have completely put the connection between the prison industrial complex that exists here in California and all over the United States and what Proposition 21 calls for, which is mass incarceration of youth into prisons. And my general feeling about it is pretty much the shared feeling of a lot of youth here in California, is that this law does not come as a big surprise to us that it even got on the ballot, because our history as a state from 187 to 209 to 227 suggests that there's been mass incarceration of people of color. Prop 21 does specifically target communities of color. So to youth, as it looks now, especially being that we have been ranked as a state as 41st in education spending, that there's some more emphasis on prison spending, which costs us more, and less emphasis on high school spending, middle school spending, education spending on the larger level. So to me, I take Proposition 21 as a personal insult. And not only that, especially being that I could be affected by it in some broad way, it kind of, you know, slaps us in the face as you saying that, you know, we're super predators, that we're always committing crime, that we can't be rehabilitated, that there's no need to spend money on our education, that there's more need to spend money on our incarceration. So even when I met Matt Ross, the question of, you know, do you feel that, you know, that the involvement of youth in this campaign, which has been very, very strong, shows that maybe as you directing the Yes on Prop 21 campaign to rethink why you guys even put this on the ballot, especially seeing youth that have already been through the rehabilitation structure of the juvenile system, saying that they would never have received that rehabilitation if Prop 21 passed. Do you rethink that? And there's no answer from the Yes on Prop 21.
Pagolia, how can people get in touch with your group, Critical Resistance Youth Force?
Critical Resistance Youth Force has an office in Oakland, and the number there is 510-444-0484.
That's 510-444-0484. I want to thank everyone who joined us today. John Lum, Chief Probation Officer at San Luis Obispo in California. Vince Beiser, Senior Editor at Mother Jones online. You can go to motherjones.com. His piece is called Money Plus Politics Equals Jailed Kids. And our Florida guest, Marie Osborne of the Miami-Dade Public Defenders. She's Chief of the Juvenile Division there. And Claudia Kemp, law student at Florida State University in Tallahassee. That does it for today's program. By the way, my co-host Juan Gonzalez is in San Francisco today. San Francisco is where he'll be talking about his new book, Harvest of Empire, The History of Latinos in America. And he's going to be tonight, you should all be relieved, at a clean and well-lighted place. A clean, well-lighted place for books is on Van Ness Avenue in San Francisco, and that's at 7:30. He'll be in San Antonio tomorrow, and on Wednesday when we talk to him, he'll be in Houston, and that night he'll be at the Nuestra Palabra bookstore. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Robert Knight and Bernard White. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!